Money FM 89.3, the best of your money. Money and Me on Your Money, only on Money FM 89.3.
Let's make some money, or at least keep what we have, or grow what we have, I should say. Welcome to Money and Me. I'm Michelle Martin. Google and Apple already have a long-standing partnership. You already use Google Maps on your iPhone, and Safari is your default browser on your iPhone, right? But now, Tim Cook, Apple's chief executive, has promised investors that the company will introduce new generative AI capabilities this year and is looking to Google's Gemini AI to power some iPhone features. So Apple and Google are in discussions over the licensing of the use of Google's AI model Gemini. Could this move help Apple catch up to its rivals in the smartphone arena, Samsung and Google, who have already added Gemini to their newest devices so users can edit videos and summarize audio recordings, for example? And what could this tie-up, if it does go through, mean for Alphabet? Then we'll switch gears and ask, earning extra income on the stocks you already own. How does that sound to you? What is stock lending? Is it safe? Is it for you? And then we'll fly over to Japan because the central bank has raised the cost of borrowing for the first time in 17 years and ask, can a retail investor position for this? All right. To help us answer all these questions, Arun Pai from the investments team at Monk's Hill Ventures. How's Thursday looking, Arun?
Good morning, Michelle. Thursday's looking pretty good right now.
Fantastic.
How's it
feel? Looking up from now, I have to say. All right. Help us understand this Apple and Google partnership if it does go through. It's preliminary. We have no details about this deal if it does go through, of course. How much of a boost do you think Apple stands to gain? What stands out for you about this potential tie-up?
You know, rarely do you see, when it's two like massive companies on either side of the deal, a potential like win-win scenario come out of this. And I think this is one of those rare deals where that's actually potentially going to materialize. And I think the stock market rewarded both parties for coming up with this, right? I think this happened a couple of days back. Google was the bigger benefactor. I think it went up like 5-6 points at one point.
Yes.
Like percentage, that is. And Apple also went up a couple of percentage points. Look, it's a proven playbook, right? Google, if you go back in time, say like 15 years or give or take, when the agreement was signed in a very hush-hush manner between Apple and Google, Google knows its search. It took its service, offered it to Apple, and Apple, what does it know? It knows its distribution and quality of its relatively closed ecosystem, I would say, for its users. Google wanted to tap into that typically more affluent segment of society that can afford the Apple phone. And they struck a deal in the back end that the Google search becomes the exclusive search engine for the Apple ecosystem. Similarly, we have this huge trend that's going on in the tech space of generative AI, LLMs, what that means for the entire search industry as a whole, to some extent. Google coming up with Gemini, albeit slightly more late to the party as compared to ChatGPT by OpenAI. Mm. But regardless, right, it's still a very, very good quality product. They obviously have basically unlimited resources at their disposal. They've thrown a lot of money at this. And then from that perspective, Google wanted a great distribution partner, founded in Apple. Apple sticking to its core, which is coming up with amazing hardware, wrapping it up nicely with their software slash services ecosystem, has taken Google's offering and is going to use it as a little bit of an experiment. So if it goes poorly, Apple can always blame Google for it. And if it goes well, then maybe at some point, similar to the way Apple replaced Intel chips from its Mac line and went into its own chip, it gives the optionality for Apple to get into this space also, if they want, right? So I think it's a very good, smart business decision from both counterparties. The biggest question mark, though, is given the negative media that came out when people started realizing that Google is basically paying Apple, I think, $6 or $8 billion a year to keep Google, to make Google the default search engine, how does that look for competition? Mm-hmm. And I think there'll be a lot of antitrust questions also in this case, where you'll have the likes of Anthropic, Claude, OpenAI, ChatGPT, like all the other smaller or bigger LLMs that are out there, saying this is not fair. You know, just because you can pay money to Apple and because you're big enough, Should that be an exclusivity? So I think that's going to be the big question mark.
Just to your point, you're totally right about Alphabet being the biggest winner in terms of share price movements over the past couple of days. So Alphabet up over the past 5 days. Overnight, we saw a gain of 5.17%. Apple also up over the past 5 days, showing a gain of about 3.28%. Do you think, even though it's late, Apple could be a big player in AI?
So there are certain things that Apple does really, really well. Right, and it's coming up with like relatively smaller consumer electronic. If you go back, like the iPod, then evolving to iPhone 1, and now at the 14th, 15th iteration that we are at right now in that space, they've launched services really well. To be very clear, though, just because you have a lot of money doesn't necessarily mean that you can always win out. A great example is the electric car, right? And I think there are unconfirmed rumors, obviously, about this, but Apple basically plonked in close to $10 billion trying to come up with their own EV. Obviously, when Elon Musk saw this, he replied with a poopy emoji on Twitter when Apple failed. But, you know, that's a separate conversation altogether. But what is interesting is that, look, Apple tried, and you got to respect a large company for trying and failing,
yeah,
right?
So publicly,
So publicly. I mean, naturally, when you plonk in $10 billion, there are going to be a lot of questions asked and everything. But they took all the people, they sifted them into like various departments of Apple. Some of them obviously did not stick around for the long journey because they wanted to go and do their own thing. But it's this level of internal disruption that's required to ensure that you don't become a dinosaur yourself and go down the path of a Nokia or BlackBerry. But again, to the point to your question, it doesn't necessarily mean success. So what does Apple have over here? It has an amazing ecosystem. It knows what its customers want. They've done a fantastic job of coming up into consumer finance doing that. Like the partnership with Goldman was so heavily lopsided that in this case, Apple basically had a huge benefit of partnering with Google. Google had to basically shut this division down, and they're trying to like sell off the entire portfolio to another bank at this point. So there are successes and failures. My core belief and why I think Apple is such an amazing company is at the end of the day, they are the ones that are facing the customer. They have that amazing relationship, amazing bond with the end customer, who's basically the peer of this product or service. As long as you maintain that reputation and you keep providing the best quality offering to the end customer, that customer will be loyal to you. And I think that's the big advantage that Apple has going for it as compared to all the other brands, even more so than Google, I would say, when it comes to customer affinity. So from that perspective, look, they're sitting in a very pretty spot. They have a whole bunch of, I'm sure, LLMs now clamoring over themselves, trying to provide their offering to Apple. Apple will figure out what in it best for them and for its end customer. Figure out what the best data points are. I'm sure there's going to be some kind of data sharing arrangement, etc. And giving the optionality, I would say, for Apple to, if they want to get into this space, they'll be able to do so at a certain point in the future. I think things are shaping out quite well for Apple, especially considering it was a bit of a laggard to this game.
So well put. You know, when people ask, who is Google's competitor, Apple would come up. And it's interesting to see them both coming together. So what do you think this partnership moving forward would mean for the competition?
I mean, at that level and scale, I think you have to be accepting that a lot of business areas, there's going to be like a frenemy concept, right? You can't be north of $1 trillion of your market cap playing in the tech space and feel that you're not going to have some kind of overlap with others. From the perspective of a partnership, I think if you've seen what Microsoft has done, has been phenomenal under Satya Nadella, right? I mean, not just the share price, but literally this was like a boring old software company that the best of tech talent never wanted to be a part of it. They would rather, like, if you took a survey of like 100 people, I'm sure like 99 would say, I'd rather work for Google than Microsoft,
yeah,
say like 10, 15 years ago. That's completely turned on its head right now. So I think if you're sitting like as Tim Cook or Sundar Pichai sitting there and seeing the amazing strides that Nadella has taken with Microsoft in terms of partnership with OpenAI, what they're doing with a bunch of other generative GenAI startups, is at the absolute cutting edge. And that is leading to a lot of discontent, I would say, that have Apple and Google actually fallen quite a bit far behind this space. So partnering up, at least for this one aspect, I think makes a lot of sense. Microsoft will obviously see this. They will try to figure out then, and knowing that mobile first is the way forward, Microsoft and Google might try and have a separate tie-up, because Apple ecosystem is doing phenomenally well as compared to Android. So I think you pick and choose which areas you can collaborate in, which areas you can have massive heads-on collision, and some areas where they'll be a little bit more strategic in nature, where you'll partner up with quote-unquote competition in some areas versus the others. And I think that's the kind of dynamic we are seeing play out, because, look, Michelle, at the end of the day, these three companies are all like multi-trillion dollar individual businesses, right? They're larger than countries' GDPs at this point. So It'll be impossible not to think that there is going to be competition in certain areas and collaboration in others.
He's Arun Pai, our guest. He's from the investments team at Monk's Hill Ventures, helping us reflect on the investment world. When I was growing up, one of my favorite books was Easy Questions, Too Hard Answers. And it was a science book. But Arun helps us understand the answers. So let's go to an investor question, Arun. An investor wants to know, a platform that I use says I can activate my account for stock lending, where, for example, I get paid 12% per year for loaning out my shares. First up, can you explain what stock lending is? Because, you know, in people's mind, what am I really lending if I can liquidate it at any time?
So yes, you can liquidate a stock. So what is the full journey, right? You have a certain amount of capital in your brokerage account. And to be clear, not everyone has the access to stock lending. You have to be of a certain net worth to be able to even get into this space, because on the back end for these brokerages, it is a little operationally intensive to take certain, to borrow certain stock, to lend it, et cetera, et cetera. But either way, considering if you say you are a person who has the ability to lend stocks to begin with, what's the entire cash flow process? You take a certain amount of capital from your bank account, deposit it in this brokerage, then you go out and you buy a certain stock that you really like, right? And the reason you're buying it is because you're hoping that the price will appreciate. Now, it's always important to know there are these players in the market called short sellers. Short selling is the mirror image of buying a stock. You buy a stock to hope that the underlying share price will track that of the business in the long run, and the share price will naturally appreciate if the business does well. Short selling is the opposite, wherein you sell the stock, hoping that the share price goes down, thereby profiting from the fact that the share price has come up, right? So It's opposite ends of the spectrum. The rule is you can't go about short selling something that you have not borrowed to begin with. And that's where brokerages come in. So if I own 100 shares of Microsoft and there's a short seller, let's call it XYZ hedge fund out of New York, is like, you know what? I want to actually short Microsoft. So what the brokerage does is I click this box saying that I'm happy to lend my shares of Microsoft. I still own the shares, but I've lent it out to someone. The brokerage takes those lent shares, assigns it, quote unquote, to the XYZ hedge fund out of New York, and the hedge fund over there shorts that stock. So if the price of Microsoft, say, goes from 100 to 110, I've made $10, and hence, ergo, the XYZ hedge fund has lost $10. And if the share price goes from $100 to $90, then I, as the person who's bought Microsoft shares, loses 10, and the hedge fund makes 10. At any point of time, the required counterparty can close out that transaction. But obviously, the market is much deeper than just me and that XYZ hedge fund, right? Imagine there are like thousands of people like me who have, quote-unquote, lent their stock. And there are hundreds or tens or thousands of hedge funds out there who are looking to short the stock. The brokerage nets it out. And that, hence, becomes a supply-demand play. Certain stocks, people will be willing to pay an interest of 12%. which basically means the hedge fund, if you think about from a hedge fund perspective or the person who's shorting the stock perspective, they believe that the stock price will depreciate or go down by substantially more than 12% over the year, because they have to pay that 12%, or let's say they have to pay 10% or 15% to the brokerage. The brokerage pays 12% to the person who's bought the stock, thereby pocketing the difference of 3%. So that's the entire cash flow segment of when I'm buying the stock, I can avail to lend it. The person who's looking to short the stock has to borrow that stock and then go about shorting it. And that's where the brokerage plays the role in the middle. That's where the interest rate of a certain stock is defined. So like GameStop, right? We talked about it a lot at your show. When was it? I think beginning of last year, when it was going up like 80x, 100x, etc. Cost of borrowing went through the roof in that case. Because so what is the ideal world? The ideal world is I am buying a stock that has a short squeeze. I say, yeah, sure, you can. I'm happy for these shares to be lent out. You give me an attractive interest rate. The short percentage increases. And then me, as in all the individual retail traders, all together decide, you know what? Forget these short people. I'm going to take back my shares and I'm not willing to lend it anymore. If there are very fewer shares to lend, there are very fewer shares to short. The person who shorted the stock on the other side, the XYZ hedge fund, they are forced to cover their short, thereby leading the share price to go up. And that's when you can have this huge short squeeze. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of nitty gritty games that can be played in the back end, especially if you're large institutional buyers or if a lot of retail players get together. But this is the overarching concept of why there's an interest rate to begin with, who's paying that interest rate to achieve what. So I hope that kind of gives you an overview.
Absolutely brilliant. Brilliant. And I'm going to listen to that over and over, and I'm sure many people will as well. What are the main risks? Are you really only at risk if your brokerage goes under? Are you not at risk if the short goes wrong, for example?
When you're lending a stock, the positive or the advantage is obviously that you receive a certain interest rate to compensate you, right? You could lend out your Microsoft shares and you will probably earn only like 1 or 2%, because there aren't that many people out there looking to short the stock. If you're going into, say, a Tesla or something else, you can lend out the shares and potentially a slightly higher rate of interest, right? So there's that aspect of knowing how much interest you receive for lending out the stock. That's on the positive side. On the negative side, think of it as you have bought the stock hoping for the stock price to rise. When you lend out the stock, you are actually enabling a short seller on the other side to execute on their trade that the share price will go down. So you're actually enabling that process to happen. Now, you get into various degrees of, say, conviction about your position and how confident you are that the share price will go up. And if at the end of the day, look, if you believe that the underlying business is that solid and stable and it's doing so well, by all means, right? Why not get that additional interest rate as like a yield enhancement tool? But just be very cognizant that you are enabling short selling to take place at the same time. The risk in terms of, that individual counterparty going bankrupt or the brokerage itself going bankrupt, that is extremely minimal, because just the way the balance sheet, the safety net of these brokerage firms are, especially like the larger ones, you can name off any of them, like Interactive Brokers, Saxo Bank, et cetera, all the ones that are the larger platforms that are available in Singapore, that risk is so minimal that I personally wouldn't evaluate that as a concern of lending or not.
So is there as close to no risks to lending out your stocks, is what you're saying?
From a counterparty going bankrupt perspective, because when you lend out the stock, technically that stock is not quote-unquote yours anymore, right? You lent it out to someone else. And if that person goes bankrupt, yes, you are able, you are a creditor, so you are able to get that stock back, but it'll have to go through a huge liquidation process.
Okay.
So, but that would be common even when you've purchased stocks and anything else, right? So I think there's a bigger issue when it comes to counterparty risk, and that's not necessarily exacerbated by lending out stock.
Okay. So someone might be interested in doing this for additional yield, and really the only issue in terms of risks is sort of abstract in terms of what are you actually enabling. You're actually enabling short selling.
Precisely.
All right. Got it.
But realize, right, like you aren't the market. I mean, Warren Buffett isn't the market. So there are way more than enough buyers and sellers and people who are willing to lend the stock out there. Interest rates will just adjust itself accordingly. The beauty is if you can engineer a short. So you say that, yes, sure. Say you, if it was legally possible, people, and this is not, this is why the whole GameStop saga came into question, right? Whether Roaring Kitty or whoever, right. whatever his
yeah.
name is,
Roaring Kitty.
Basically mm. colluded with other buyers to engineer a short squeeze. That was a big question mark.
Yeah.
So in a world where you and, like, say, 10 million other people who have all bought the stock say yes, happy to lend it out, the other, and say the company's business fundamentals are terrible, the company should be going bankrupt, yada, 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 the other counterparty decides to short, great, life is going well, and then suddenly you and the 10 million other people decide, okay, you know what, we're all going to reduce the amount of stock that we've lent by, like, 99.9%. Immediately, and you are the market in that case then, right? So then immediately the person who short sold is forced to cover the position because you legally can't short a stock naked, that stock has to be borrowed, thereby you engineer a short squeeze. Illegal, it's not even in practice, it's basically highly improbable for that to happen. You'll have once in moonshots like GameStop that happens. But anyway, just from an intellectual discussion perspective, I just wanted to share that.
Interesting, thanks. That's the start of a graphic novel for me, actually. Very interesting. All right, let's look at Japan's interest rate now. It's a widely anticipated yet historic move, Japan's central bank raising interest rates on Tuesday for the first time since 2007, which means the end of the world's only negative rates regime. Arun, how will markets feel it? Will global markets feel this?
Global markets, maybe not so much. I think it's a long time coming, right? And by a long time, I think Japan has raised interest rate after 17 years, if I'm not mistaken, something like that. Like, it's really a very long period of time. And you have that aspect, and it's not just the interest rate part, right? I think what is also worth noting is the central bank, the BOJ, is stepping off the pedal on doing YCC, or yield curve control, which basically means the BOJ buying treasuries, or like the government bond, in the back end of the curve. When you buy the bonds, that means the yield comes down. Yield comes down to ensure that when another person, an individual or a company, is looking to borrow at the back end of the curve, that interest rate is artificially low. Why did BOJ do all of this? To kind of force people to go out there and spend and do infrastructure spending from the company perspective, CapEx spending, etc., by artificially keeping interest rates low. What's happened over the past couple of years, like the rest of the world is seeing in terms of inflation increasing? The same thing was happening in Japan. I think what finally forced BOJ's hand was you had a lot of like these really large corporations in Japan being forced by the union to increase wages. And that was something that we had really not seen in Japan for a very, very long time. Higher cost of living, unions forcing large companies to increase wages, and that trickle-down effect in terms of boosting consumer spending, etc., is exactly what the BOJ wanted to see. Inflation creeping back up. Is the inflation because of internal reasons or external reasons, like supply chain issues, trade wars, etc., etc.? That's something I think that the central bank is still a bit wary of. But at least I think Japan was the last country to have negative interest rates. They're going back to a more market normalized yield curve, bond trade, which I think in the long term is healthier for the market. So I think overall it's a positive aspect from an investor perspective. Is that observation a bit late in the day? Obviously, given the share price, the index, I think it's at 34, 35 year highs at this point. But look, there's still some attractive value out there, I feel. It's not like from a forward PE trading multiples, this is it's extremely overinflated, I would say. There's still value there.
We have about 5 million more questions, but we're going to leave it there. Arun, thank you so much for joining us and letting us pick your brain all the time.
Pleasure as always for having me. Thank you, Michelle.
Arun Pai from the investments team at Monk's Hill Ventures.
Before acting on the information on Money FM, please consider if it's suitable for your own investment objectives, financial situation, and risk tolerance. To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at audio.sg or download the audio app. That's AWEDIO, audio, at the App Store and Google Play.